On March 26, 1884, 2 days before a mass meeting turned into a lynch mob of thousands, which led to National Guard troops shooting citizens in the streets, the 4th Annual Conference of the United States National Guard Association met in Cincinnati. For a national conference, it was a pretty small gathering. Because the National Guard Association was composed of volunteers who were trying to create nationwide standards for state militias, and who were doing it with no help or funding from the federal government, the conference was considered very well attended when 25 participants came from 15 states. In addition to being small, the conference also didn't accomplish a lot. It included sightseeing and festivities. It probably resulted in some serious casualties to the Burnett House Hotel's liquor and cigar stock. But it did manage to conclude with some meaningful resolutions. One committee was created to draft a national uniform code for structuring and training National Guard regiments. And a second committee was assigned the task of lobbying Congress for better funding. In 1808, Congress set funding for the National Guard at $200,000 a year, and it had not increased it since. That's despite inflation, the United States adding 21 states, and the population growing 12-fold. The National Guard Association supported pending legislation that would increase funding to $600,000, which was still grossly inadequate. Today, that would be the equivalent of around $4 to $5 million to train, arm, uniform, and otherwise equip every member of the National Guard across the United States. So even then, in 19th century dollars, it would have cost an estimated $50 million to do that right, meaning that $600,000 was a tripling of the budget, yes, but it was a really modest ask. With these committees formed and their tasks assigned, the National Conference concluded with a dinner, which included stout rum punch and speeches from members across the country. Captain John J. Desmond of Cincinnati's 1st Regiment was encouraged to speak by his friends. He demurred, but after some prodding, he rose and he addressed the room. Now, Desmond was very well liked, and as a lawyer in civilian life, his off-the-cuff remarks were eloquent and very well received. In hindsight, they also became very eerily prescient. Desmond said that he believed that the government should have a military force to enforce the laws when exigencies required it. And he thought that the National Guard, composed as it was of citizen volunteers, was the best body to fulfill that need. He believed in the mission, and he was proud of his service. He concluded by saying, quote, "I don't know whether I shall ever be called on to sustain the law in the manner I have indicated. I trust and I hope I never shall. But if I am so called, I promise you that I will prove that I am something more than a mere wearer of peacock feathers, a featherbed soldier," unquote. As the room erupted in hearty applause, nobody there had any reason to suspect that Desmond would receive the call to duty that he hoped would never come within the next 24 hours. When it came, he proved himself a leader and a man of courage. According to the accepted history of the courthouse riot, Captain John J. Desmond of the Ohio 1st Regiment National Guard was murdered by rioters on Saturday night. Desmond was a good man, smart, he was honorable, and he was courageous under harrowing circumstances. Regardless of who killed him, his death was a genuine tragedy. But who killed him became extremely important afterwards. Because of all the blood that would be spilled between March 28 and 30th, of all the dozens of lives lost and hundreds of lives permanently altered, Captain John J. Desmond would be the only member of the Ohio National Guard to be killed by the crowd. Today, a statue of Desmond still stands in the Hamilton County Courthouse, memorializing him as the sole martyr of the courthouse riot. The one life that mattered, because he was a soldier murdered by a mob that was so dangerous that its members had to be mowed down in the street at random. Desmond is the sole death that posthumously justified the wanton use of deadly force against so many civilians. Desmond's murder was the rallying cry for the National Guard's heroism under mortal threat. But the problem with this story, and the problems that it helped exacerbate, and the lessons that it kept us from learning, the problem is that there are solid reasons to believe that this accepted version of history is complete bullshit. I'm Mike Morgan, a writer, attorney, historian, and Amy, I was once officially, truly, genuinely declared public enemy number one by Monroe Township, Ohio, before I even graduated from high school.
And that is a separate story, something that I hope we will get to eventually, but I'm Amy Morgan. I am also an attorney. I enjoy history, but I'm really more of a true crime and politics junkie, and I'm helping tell the story because it involves all of those things.
And this is Truth Deferred, Season 1, The National Guard Massacre, a true story about biased media, corruption, murder, a slaughter of unarmed civilians by National Guard troops, and the cover-up that followed. A cover-up which hid the truth so well that this is the first time it's being told.
There are a lot of what-ifs in this story, and most of them involved inept politicians. If either Cincinnati policemen or local National Guardsmen had been used to stand guard at the jail on Friday night in anticipation of problems following the music hall meeting, the situation may not have escalated. But by the time soldiers arrived, all control had been lost, and dozens of young, poorly trained guardsmen were thrust into an angry crowd of thousands. It's understandable that they became reactionary and trigger-happy, leading to the needless loss of a lot of innocent lives. The goal for Saturday was to avoid making the mistakes of Friday, but different people in a muddled chain of command had completely opposite opinions about how to accomplish that goal.
In the early dawn, there was a lot of optimism. A riot had been quelled, that a mass lynching had been prevented, and that the threat of further carnage had passed when the streets were cleared. But by mid-morning, people were starting to gather in the alleys and the side streets around Government Square. Most of them seemed to be curiosity seekers, but the mood was dark and it was ominous. A combination of truth and wild rumors about what the National Guard had done the night before had spread throughout the city, and it was engendering a lot of anger. Much of the city thought that there were now two sets of murderers being harbored in the jail. The traditional criminals, who were now accompanied by the killers wearing National Guard uniforms.
Which presented a dilemma. If Cincinnatians swelled into an angry mob of thousands again, but at least half of the anger was now directed at the National Guard, would more troops prevent further violence, or would it help ensure it?
That was a hard question. How do you use the National Guard to quell a possible riot that, if it happens again, will have been largely caused by the National Guard? Do more troops prevent problems, or do they exacerbate them? Three people needed to make this decision, and they should have made it together. They were Ohio Governor Hoadley, Cincinnati Mayor Stevens, and Hamilton County Sheriff Morton Hawkins. But that is definitely not what happened.
By mid-morning, Sheriff Hawkins was off the fence. He wanted as many soldiers as he could get. As both sheriff and commander of an unaffiliated militia regiment called the Veterans Guards, Hawkins called upon his own troops, ordering all of them to report to the jail by 7:30 that evening. He also worked with Colonel Hunt, commander of Cincinnati's 1st Regiment of the Ohio National Guard, to call up the rest of his 542 troops. And after conferring with Hunt, Hawkins telegraphed Governor Hoadley at 11:01 a.m., asking him to send more troops to Cincinnati.
Almost every aspect of this then went wrong. In addition to the 40 soldiers that had saved the jail the night before, but had done it by needlessly killing a lot of people in the process, many more members of the 1st Regiment had reported to the jail by noon. But they were funneling in more slowly than they should have. And this was partly due to willful disobedience. One company of Sheriff Hawkins' Veterans Guards Regiment sent him a message saying, quote, "This company have, by a unanimous vote, declined to assist in guarding the jail," unquote. And Colonel Hunt reported similar problems, saying that his troops were, quote, "being terrorized and influenced by the press and citizens generally," unquote. Only a half dozen members of the 1st Regiment flatly, blatantly refused to report for duty in the end. But the total number of troops that reported to the jail over the course of Saturday was a fraction of the number of the total roll call. Like many members of the community as a whole, some National Guardsmen objected to defending the jail because they supported the idea of a mass lynching.
The next problem was Mayor Stevens. Ohio law made the mayor the commander-in-chief in times of civil unrest. But Mayor Stevens was sick. There was no doubt that Stevens had been seriously ill. He had canceled a planned trip to New Orleans and had been bedridden with bronchial pneumonia since March 20th. Now, Stevens was a 61-year-old businessman. He was a moderate Democrat who had been elected due to his common sense and general decency. But his complete absence from any decision-making has never been explained. And it frankly remains unexplainable. Telephones were still rare, but wealthy people had them. And Stevens was both affluent and the mayor of a major city. He also lived close to downtown, and he should have been easily reachable by telegraph or by courier. It is possible that the people around him shielded him from the news of Friday night and barred visitors or calls out of concern for his health, but for some unknown reason, no one seems to have consulted Mayor Stevens. Not Governor Hoadley, not Sheriff Hawkins, and Stevens doesn't appear to have attempted to get involved until Sunday.
But arguably the biggest problem was Governor Hoadley's indecisiveness. After the fact, Hoadley claimed that he immediately responded to the call for more troops, and he moved with all possible speed. But that's revisionist history. The truth is that after Sheriff Hawkins asked Governor Hoadley to send troops, Hoadley telegraphed a wealthy Cincinnati insurance executive, a friend of his and a supporter named Henry Erner, to ask him what he should do. And to answer that question, Erner, the unelected, completely unqualified insurance executive, didn't consult either the mayor or the sheriff, or even go to the jail and see what had happened. Instead, he went to the floor of the Cincinnati Stock Exchange to get the opinion of other random rich guys.
And the consensus of the rich was that more troops would create more problems and would just add fuel to the flames.
But Sheriff Hawkins had a different opinion. And at 11:55 a.m., after receiving no response to his 11:01 message, he telegraphed Hoadley, quote, "Situation serious. Expect deadly work tonight. Send 14th and 4th regiments and have other troops in readiness. We need 2,000 men, mob armed and being reinforced."
Governor Hoadley did call the 14th Regiment from Columbus and the 4th Regiment from Dayton into service, but he ordered them to assemble at their armories and await further orders rather than sending them straight to Cincinnati. Hoadley then telegraphed Hawkins back in response to his request for 2,000 soldiers, asking him if 300 troops would be enough.
Meanwhile, Hoadley kept asking random rich guys in Cincinnati what he should do. And they kept telling him that the trouble was over and that more troops were unnecessary. Insurance executive Henry Erner finally consulted Sheriff Hawkins and Colonel Hunt to get their opinions after Hoadley specifically told him to do so, to go talk to the people who had actual firsthand knowledge. But by 3 o'clock, Hoadley was still being told by Cincinnati's businessmen that he shouldn't send troops, while Hawkins was frantically pleading for more troops. And the result was the 14th and 4th Regiments of the Ohio National Guard sitting around waiting for orders to go to Cincinnati, which obviously took a lot longer to do in 1884 than it does today. They all needed to board regularly scheduled trains to make the trip, and it took hours.
When Henry Erner, the insurance executive, finally leaves the stock exchange and goes to the jail, seeing the staved-in jail doors, broken windows, and all of the various signs of the size of the lynch mob from the previous night for the first time around 4 o'clock, he sees these things for the first time after a day's worth of contradicting the sheriff, and finally consults with the sheriff and Colonel Hunt. Erner finally tells Governor Hoadley that he should do what Sheriff Hawkins has been begging him to do since 11 a.m. Earlier in the day, Hoadley promised Hawkins troops by 8 at the latest. But by the time Hoadley gave the order to move forward, it was impossible for troops to reach Cincinnati before 9 p.m. And it would turn out to be later than that. The 14th Regiment left Columbus with around 500 troops between 5:30 and 6 p.m. And the 4th Regiment left Dayton at 6:15.
And even after Governor Hoadley had troops moving, his order said that when they got into the town, they were supposed to remain at the train stations. Hoadley was also sending Gatling guns. Now, these were the original machine guns. A Gatling gun looked like a cannon with multiple barrels that spun around on hand rotation. They shot these huge caliber rounds, and they could fire between 400 to 1,000 rounds a minute. Now, the thought of using one of these guns on a large, tightly clustered crowd of civilians should have been a horrifyingly bad idea to anyone with either half a brain or an ounce of human decency. But despite this, two of these guns were now making their way to the Hamilton County Jail right now anyway. Part of one of Hoadley's telegraph messages summarizes his combination of indecisiveness, incoherent strategy, and, frankly, lack of regard for human life. He wrote, quote, "The troops are under orders not to leave railroad depots except by specific orders of sheriff. unless absolutely necessary. Far better to scare than shoot. But if shooting begins, somebody must suffer. Pity it should be the wrong man when so many need shooting. Unquote. Now it's odd that he assumed that innocent people would take the bulk of the gunfire, but it was one of the rare times in the course of that day that Governor Hoadley would be right about absolutely anything.
Hoadley spent his morning and afternoon frantically seeking advice from multiple sources. Mayor Stevens being virtually the only affluent businessman in town that he did not consult. He sought the opinion of both John McLean, who was the editor of the Cincinnati Inquirer, and Murat Halstead, the editor of the rival Commercial Gazette. Of all the advice that he received throughout the day, Halstead's response stands out for being a rare, extremely balanced, and wise assessment of the situation. Halstead told the governor, quote, "There is great danger here. If an overwhelming military force were here now, it might keep peace. If it comes late, I fear harm. The military last night meant well, but were not well handled, and people were exasperated against them."
This is why the delays by indecision were important and helped ensure catastrophe. Halstead was right. If soldiers had been positioned outside of the jail the previous night, before the crowd arrived, they could have prevented serious problems. In hindsight, it's easy to argue that using police rather than soldiers would have helped prevent disaster. And there's an equal case for using an overwhelming show of controlled military force in advance of disorder erupting in the streets. But people died the night before because volunteer soldiers were sent into the middle of a raging mob. This night, Saturday night, a failure of leadership and strategy ensured that some version of the same thing was about to happen again.
Colonel Hunt of the 1st Regiment had some of his men erect 3 defensive barricades in the late afternoon, built of overturned wagons, stolen doors, barrels, and other scavenged wood. One was built on Sycamore Street, about a block north of the jail. Another blocked the Sycamore Street approach from the south. The Miami and Erie Canal separated the central business district from Over the Rhine, the German neighborhood at the core of the Cincinnati's drinking problem. The third barricade was built on the bridge over the canal on Main Street, which ran in front of the courthouse. This was to force people coming from Over the Rhine to use a more distant route. It was not to protect the courthouse. Aside from closing it for business on Saturday when it was usually open, and adding a few extra security guards on duty, nothing was done to protect the courthouse. There were no prisoners in it, and there was no reason to suspect that it was going to be a target. In hindsight, it would have been a great idea to use the hundreds of troops available locally to form a perimeter all the way around Government Square, composed of the jail, courthouse, and a large fenced yard in between. But the courthouse was left exposed.
As the hours ticked past, the city filled with an angry, frenetic energy. A circular was distributed around town calling for vigilante groups to form. Any burner juror who hadn't fled the city or wasn't in hiding was in danger. Threats to lynch T.C. Campbell were rampant. One of the most persistent, ominous rumors said that a large, highly organized lynch mob was forming in Newport, Kentucky, immediately across the river, and that it would cross the river like an invading army to clear out the jail. This rumor was false, but it persisted, and it was part of a growing anxiety, leading to police on both sides of the river, curbing pedestrian traffic across the bridges, and an entire city put on edge.
Cincinnati policemen, armed with only clubs and revolvers, are ordered to form a front line that holds the crowds a distance from the barricades. If they are overrun, they are supposed to fall back and pass through the narrow entrances in the bulwarks. If this time comes, the roughly 60 militiamen stationed behind each barricade are expected to issue a warning to the crowd. And if they don't retreat, they're authorized to shoot to kill, ideally without hitting policemen. Cincinnatians do not want to attack their policemen. The city is revolting against a broken judicial system, and now they're outraged at the National Guard, both for murdering citizens and for stopping a mass lynching. Policemen are still respected, while citizens chant "kill, kill" at members of the 1st Regiment who are reporting for duty at the jail, throwing rocks at the soldiers while trying not to hit the cops.
One of the stones thrown at soldiers goes wild, and it smashes out a window in the treasurer's office of the courthouse. The sound of breaking glass seems to be a trigger for parts of the crowd. And seeing that there is no response from inside the courthouse, more people start intentionally throwing rocks to smash out courthouse windows. This starts around 7:30 p.m. Sheriff Hawkins' Veterans Guard Regiment should have all reported to duty by now, and most of them have. So have members of the 1st Regiment. Hundreds of men are stationed at three barricades or the Gatling gun, but most of them seem to be inside the jail. In addition to rocks, someone fires a shotgun at the courthouse, and the sound of gunfire puts all the guardsmen at the barricades in high alert.
At roughly 8 p.m., men break into the treasurer's office on the first floor of the courthouse. They light a torch and use it to start a fire, throwing on rugs, smashing furniture into kindling, and tossing on public records. The fire struggles at first, but layers of combustible varnish on woodwork causes the fire to flare. It roars and begins spreading throughout the office. Factions of arsonists then begin moving south through the building, room to room, setting the commissioners, auditors, recorders, coroners, and sheriff's offices ablaze. Transcripts, indictments, court rulings, wills, surveys, plat maps, and deeds all begin burning with desks and chairs.
Earlier in the day, Governor Hoadley had promised Sheriff Hawkins that troops from the 14th and the 4th Regiments from Columbus and Dayton would be in Cincinnati by 8 o'clock. If that had happened, maybe the courthouse would have been guarded. Maybe not. Maybe the sheer number of soldiers would have been a deterrent against setting the courthouse on fire. Maybe it wouldn't have been. But after the courthouse started burning, control was officially lost. And it was lost while troops were still on trains into Cincinnati. Just like the night before, these troops would enter an angry mob of thousands. Now with the streets lit for blocks by the burning county government.
But dozens of men were already stationed at a barricade on Sycamore Street, just south of the jail. From their vantage point, they couldn't see people in front of the courthouse. But when men started battering in the southern side entrance of the courthouse, they were within sight lines and firing range of the troops at this barricade, and their axe prompted troops to shoot an estimated 100 rounds in roughly 30 seconds. According to the Commercial Gazette, someone was using the Gatling gun on the crowd. Other reports indicate rifle fire, although they didn't have to be mutually exclusive.
And regardless of what weapons they were coming from, large caliber bullets start driving men to the pavement in scores. A smooth-faced young man crumples to the pavement from a fatal gunshot wound slightly above his heart.
A heavy-set man with black, curly hair and a Napoleonic goatee and mustache is standing near Main Street when bullets pierce his hand and rip a horrific wound in his groin.
Another young man, clearly a laborer by his clothes, is shot in the chest.
A fourth man, who someone believes is named John Harris, has his cheek blown away and a gaping wound ripped through his neck. He is carried into Kinsback's drugstore, which is becoming a triage center. Inside Kinsback's, he dies on the floor.
An army of Cincinnati policemen are gathered on 8th Street, just a couple of blocks south. But it's unclear what they can do. The combination of the courthouse arson and the firing on the crowd turns everything into unmanageable chaos somewhere between 8:20 and 9 o'clock p.m.
At around 9:30, the Ohio National Guard 4th Regiment from Dayton arrives at a Cincinnati train depot. A deputy sheriff in plain clothes is sent to meet commanding officer Colonel Mott and his men. The deputy tells them to follow him to 9th and Walnut, less than 3 blocks from the courthouse. This is where the streets turn into a sea of thousands of people. Most just curious, but some intent on violence against the National Guard. Colonel Mott's men are ordered to affix bayonets to their rifles, but to leave them unloaded and press their way through the crowd for 3 blocks, get to the courthouse, and establish a perimeter around the courthouse. The 4th contains about 400 men, but this is still a poorly planned suicidal mission.
Colonel Mott doesn't trust the judgment of the deputy, and he believes that there has to be a better plan than this. So he refuses to move his troops until Sheriff Hawkins meets with him personally. So Hawkins leaves the jail, but he's too intimidated to walk several blocks through the crowd in his uniform. So he sends the deputy back with the exact same information, telling Mott that there's no safer route and that he should move forward. By the time the deputy returns, Mott's men have been standing in a hostile crowd, surrounded by people who are mocking and threatening them. And that became too much for a lot of them. I mean, these are young, untrained volunteers, poorly trained volunteers, at least. So the 4th Regiment has started to disappear into saloons. Some of the men who brought a change of clothes have taken off their uniforms. Many of them have returned to the train station, which was where they were originally supposed to await clear orders. But by the time Hawkins' deputy returns to them, a lot of the troops have either vanished into the city or they've boarded a train back to Dayton. A lot of men from the 4th succumbed to fear that evening. In the days ahead, the 4th would be branded a regiment of cowards. And people, including Governor Hoadley and Colonel Hunt of the 1st Regiment, would both blame the 4th Regiment for the loss of the courthouse, claiming that if they had followed orders, they would have saved the building. Now, that became accepted fact, but it wasn't actually factually possible. If they had made it to the courthouse, they may have been able to clear a path for firemen. But even in that scenario, which is highly doubtful, due to Governor Hoadley's waffling earlier in the day, the courthouse would have already been engulfed in flames by the time Dayton's troops stepped off the train.
Like the night before, groups of men decided to loot gun stores for weapons and ammunition. trying to rob a gun store is usually a bad idea, and this was no exception. The first two men tried to enter the store. They were shot dead by store employees. One was 25 years old, the other was 27. Several more people were shot out front. There was a back-and-forth battle between store owners and their employees and the crowd through the night, but the store was held secure and it did not become a source of weapons or ammunition for the crowd.
We open this episode talking about Captain John J. Desmond of the 1st Regiment. Desmond was sent with another guardsman and two Cincinnati police officers to rush through the underground tunnel that connected the jail to the courthouse. Then, help firemen reach the courthouse to put out the fire. Sending just four men on this mission was insanity, and it's unclear why anybody thought that was a good plan. And ultimately, it got Desmond killed. But how it got him killed, at least in my humble opinion, how it got him killed is still up for debate. While the second guardsman in this group was in a crouched position, loading his rifle, he was shot in the shoulder. The bullet traveled at a downward trajectory through his body to exit near the base of his spine. It was a terrible wound, but that guardsman would survive, unlike Desmond. Desmond was standing next to him when a large caliber bullet blew off part of his skull, killing him instantly.
There are at least two versions of where Desmond was standing when he was shot. According to the 1st Regiment's official report, he was standing in a courthouse doorway when he was shot by an unidentified member of the crowd. This contradicts initial eyewitness testimony that said Desmond was out of the building and standing on Main Street when he was shot.
We may only be talking about a difference of a few feet, but that could be a world apart of difference in the question of who shot him. If he was standing inside the courthouse, he could not have been shot by National Guardsmen. He would have had to have been shot by a murderous rioter. But if he was standing on the street, he could have been standing roughly where other people were getting randomly shot by the 1st Regiment.
In one version of events, Desmond was the martyr that he became. He was murdered by someone with a gun large enough to blow part of his head off. If true, that meant that some of the crowd, or at least someone, was intentionally targeting National Guardsmen with lethal force.
We'll get into the investigations to find Desmond's murderer in the next episode, but for now, it's curious to me to note, if this gunman existed, he seems to have shot Desmond and the other National Guardsmen, then he just left for the evening. But the alternative to the mystery gunman is that Desmond was not the one guardsman murdered by the savage mob. He was, in fact, just one of a long list of people who were murdered by the National Guard during random gunfire into crowds.
By around 10 o'clock, the courthouse is completely engulfed in flames. It was constructed mostly of masonry and iron and considered generally fireproof, but its interior woodwork furniture, carpeting, and over a century's worth of public records are highly flammable. Cincinnati's Law Library is considered the most complete collection of legal text in the entire country, containing over 20,000 volumes, including ancient books from Europe tracing to the origins of the Western legal system. It all turns into ash as the flames reach stories high and light up the night sky for blocks.
It's an amazing spectacle, and thousands of people are drawn to see the fire. Johnny Schmidt is one of them. Now, he's a typical 14-year-old boy, rambunctious, and he's going crazy in his family's small Over the Rhine apartment because he's being held back from going to watch a once-in-a-lifetime fire. His mom doesn't want him to go because she thinks it could be dangerous. But Johnny is persistent, and he convinces her that she's being silly, that he'll stay out of trouble, and he'll stay out of danger. So she finally relents, and he goes tearing down Wall Street to go see this amazing spectacle. And Johnny Schmidt isn't gone long. Within an hour, acquaintances carry him back to his mother. Dead with a bullet through his head.
Ben Fink is among the city's ample ranks of German-born citizens. He is a 40-year-old shoemaker with a shop on Sycamore Street and an apartment nearby on Walnut. Fink has to walk past the courthouse to get home to his wife and child. And after closing for the night, he cannot resist pausing to watch the fire. Fink tries to keep a safe distance from the turmoil, but as he stands on the fray of the crowd with his hands stuffed into his jacket pockets, a soldier's bullet passes through his hand and into his abdomen at around 10 p.m. He's carried to a nearby saloon where he dies.
Henry Powers, 23, a horseshoer for a living. He's walking up Main Street towards the blazing courthouse. But he is still over a block away from it when he is shot through both legs below the knee. He's taken to the city hospital where, unlike many other people that night, Powers keeps his limbs. But after weeks in the hospital, his prognosis quickly, unexpectedly turns dim. His legs, as it turns out, should have been amputated. An infection develops in one of the wounds, then it races through his bloodstream. Because Henry Powers doesn't die until April 25th, he winds up not being counted among the riot's official casualties.
As two sex workers saunter up an eerily deserted Sycamore Street, policemen plastered against the walls of buildings at the intersection of 8th hail them over. The women resist at first, leery of police, and insistent on their right to go watch the fire, but the cops are persuasive. Drawing the ladies' attention to four corpses that have been dragged out in the middle of the street helps illustrate their point. The officers are stationed at this intersection to prevent people from walking past an arbitrary line in the sand that these women have come perilously close to crossing. The troops shout a warning to anyone who wanders within a block of the jail and shoot at anyone who proceeds. The four dead men in the street ignored that warning. Even the cops have to keep themselves out of the line of fire. Drunks are the biggest problem. Indignant men stumble past, loudly slurring insults, and are executed for it.
While the troops behind the Sycamore Street barricade are at least shouting warnings, the ones on Main Street are not. William Buck, who is a veteran soldier himself, is trying to take cover behind a telephone pole at 8th and Main Street when a rifle cartridge rips through both of his thighs. He's pulled off the field of slaughter and he's taken to city hospital. Although he's 60 years old, Buck is tenacious. And despite the ghastly nature of his wounds and his legs, he keeps insisting that he'll be fine, and he repeatedly tries to leave the hospital. He's led back to his bed each time because he's not in a condition to leave. His wounds are actually much more severe than he admits. And despite his heroic stubbornness to live, Mr. Buck doesn't make it out of the hospital until his lifeless body is carried out on April 7th. Like others we have discussed, because he dies over a week after being shot, he will not even be counted on the official list of victims.
James Green, a 20-year-old streetcar conductor, is enjoying an evening out with a friend, Ben Herzog. The young men go to a barber shop to get their hair cut. Then Green decides to buy a new hat. He and Herzog are just walking past the melee around the jail when a bullet tears into his chest, grazing his lung. Doctors helping the wounded at Keyshawn's drugstore give him immediate medical attention. And James Green miraculously survives, becoming one of the hundreds of seriously wounded.
Around 10:30, the 14th Regiment from Columbus, the one that was supposed to arrive by 8 o'clock, steps onto a Cincinnati train platform. Unlike the 4th Regiment, they are met by Quartermaster General Michael Ryan of Governor Hoadley's staff, as well as a sheriff's deputy who is carrying clear, explicit written instructions from Sheriff Hawkins. Troops, who number roughly 425, load their weapons, affix their bayonets, and they begin stoically walking several blocks to the jail. They are cursed and they are jeered at, and a few people throw rocks, but there are no apparent attempts to shoot at any of them.
On Main Street, in front of the burning courthouse, the soldiers form a line and use their bayonets to start herding the crowd away from the building and down the street. For a while, this is methodical and bloodless. The troops maintain their composure, and most of the crowd are just curious bystanders. But then something changes. Members of the crowd get unruly, and troops start opening fire on the crowd, immediately killing 5 men and wounding dozens more. Official reports will later claim great restraint by the guardsmen and specific targeting of dangerous individuals, but all eyewitness accounts refute this, including people who continue to be moving targets for soldiers as they try to run away.
The 14th Regiment also brought an additional Gatling gun, and they positioned it on Main Street, aiming it towards thousands of people on Court Street. By 1 a.m., the soldiers have successfully cleared the streets around the courthouse and jail. They've done it with a high cost of human lives.
Before the wounded could be taken to the hospital, they have to be drug off the field of battle into a safe space. Saloons and drugstores are turned into emergency triage centers. Ferdinand Kinzbach's drugstore on the corner of Court and Walnut, just a couple blocks west of the courthouse, becomes the most dangerous place to treat the wounded. Minutes after the troops fire their first volley of the evening into the crowd, 4 wounded men are carried into the store. Doctors are summoned, and a long, busy night kicks into gear. Within 15 minutes, 7 more people are helped or carried, bleeding over the threshold. Doctors become the only real, unequivocal heroes of the evening, working desperately at Kinzbach's from the time the first victims arrived until after 3 a.m. They treat 49 wounded in the course of the evening, watching 15 of them die despite their efforts. Another 15 will lose at least one limb to amputation.
Floors and countertops are converted into operating tables at Kinzbach's. The dead are tucked under counters or shelves at first, but due to a lack of space, many remain on the floor, which becomes slippery with blood. When a police patrol wagon backs up to the front door to transport the wounded to the hospital, it draws the attention of the guardmen, who then fire a volley directly at the drugstore. 2 men are shot in the doorway, and bullets pierce the storefront windows. A rifle cartridge passes within an inch of Dr. Morton's head, and Dr. Evans briefly fears that he's been killed when a crush of bullets shatters store windows and he's hit by a small piece of broken glass. For a moment, the doctors can only hunker down as everybody in the drugstore is gripped by the fear that the National Guard, is advancing towards them to murder everybody inside.
In Columbus, Governor Hoadley hears about the burning courthouse, the problem with the 4th Regiment, and all of the killing. He rants about the 4th Regiment, mourns the loss of the law library, but his communications are hauntingly devoid of any inquiry about the number of civilian casualties. Around 3 a.m., when he receives word that the streets are clear, he sends out multiple telegraphs repeating some version of the same sentence. Quote, "Our boys have whipped the mob, but you may have to do it again tomorrow night," unquote. With this in mind, Hoadley begins frantically calling up every member of the Ohio National Guard and deploying them to Cincinnati.
In the Sunday morning dawn, the streets are silent. The city hospital receives 42 more wounded men between late Saturday and the pre-dawn hours of Sunday. Two of these die in the hallway before they can receive treatment. Dozens of people face amputations and excruciating pain.
After being completely missing in action for the last 2 days, Mayor Stevens shows up for work on Sunday morning. He seems to function very well for a man who was too sick to be of any use when the city was being torn apart. Working with General Finley, the adjutant general and highest-ranking member of the Ohio National Guard, who also took an unnecessarily long time showing up for duty, the mayor and the general turned City Hall into a military command center and began bivouacking hundreds of troops on the City Hall lawn.
Everyone inside the jail is tense and exhausted. From soldiers to prisoners, who still know that the city is full of people who want to break down the doors and hang them from the nearest lamppost. Outside, more barricades are being erected with overturned wagons and barrels, including in front of the courthouse. Roughly a block from the barricades, Cincinnati police establish a second perimeter, holding back growing crowds without barricades. Decades before body armor for police, they are only protected by their billy clubs and their sidearms. And this somehow works for the most part, although it isn't a solid, consistent wall of men. And a drunk guy slips past the police on Court Street, and he starts walking purposely towards the National Guard barricade in the front of the courthouse, raising a revolver as he does so. Now, a line of soldiers respond to this by pointing their rifles at the man with the gun, but by extension, also the crowd of curiosity seekers behind him. The crowd gets terrified and begins to run in all directions away from the line of fire. Over 1,000 men, women, and children start fleeing in panic. And this frightens horses that are leading wagons that join in what becomes an increasingly dangerous stampede. And while these curiosity seekers are running away, running for their lives, a Gatling gun is trained on this running, terrified crowd. Fortunately, before any shots are fired at them, a single policeman tackles the man with the revolver, restrains him, and walks him off to jail. Now, the incident further embitters everyone who witnesses it against the National Guard, but it is also one of many examples over the weekend of Cincinnati police officers saving lives through a combination of restrained force and genuinely true heroism.
Violence never escalated to a meaningful threat on Sunday, although there were several skirmishes. Some people, probably kids, shoved one of the horse-drawn streetcars off its tracks, disrupting transportation for a while.
Another group of idiots invaded Music Hall to steal cannons that were displayed there, but the cannons had already been moved.
And, repeating the scene from earlier in the day, somebody gets past police and raises a huge revolver at one of the National Guard barricades. This time, there isn't a Cincinnati policeman to intervene before he starts firing. Rather than targeting the shooter, a whole line of troops begin shooting at random, and more troops stationed on the roof of the armory down Court Street joined in. Possibly because they are aiming high as a warning, nobody is killed, but one man is shot in the knee and leg, and it is another cause of growing ill will against the National Guard.
A combination of Cincinnati police and a few guardsmen drive off and arrest young men who are looting a pawn shop. One of the guardsmen is shot in the leg, and although nobody knows if he is shot by another guardsman or by a cop or by a looter, but since Captain John J. Desmond, this becomes the only serious bullet wound suffered by a member of the National Guard.
The first deadly encounter on Sunday happened around 2 in the afternoon at the barricade on the Main Street Canal Bridge. According to the 14th Regiment's official report, people on the north over the Rhine side of the canal were hitting the soldiers manning the post with stones and, quote, firing at the guards, unquote. Finally, a man with a revolver raised it towards the troops and threw a rock at the lieutenant in command. The report does not explain why the man with the gun threw a rock.
More importantly, witnesses all told a very different version of this event. Young boys were throwing small rocks at the canal bridge. Soldiers ordered them to stop, but they started calling them names and continuing to throw rocks at the bridge instead. And the soldiers raised their weapons at the children. In response to this, Fred Schmaltz stepped forward from a crowd that was milling around on Main Street, and Schmaltz decides to take a stand. He's a bartender, he's a gregarious, likable young guy, but this offends him so much that he makes a moral stand against National Guardsmen aiming weapons at kids. He walks towards the bridge, and he stands there, just staring at the troops. He isn't armed. He doesn't throw anything. He doesn't even shout or make threats. He just stands his ground and refuses to move when they order him to walk away. One of the soldiers raises a pistol and shoots at him. He misses, maybe intentionally. But Schmaltz continues to stand his ground in silent protest. This angers the guardmen so much that they raise their rifles and they shoot towards the crowd of roughly 100 people. Once again, they probably shot high because they didn't hit anybody in the crowd, with the exception of aiming directly for Schmaltz. A rifle round enters his side and passes through his body, exiting through his back. People rush to him, and they call for a doctor, but there's nothing that can be done. Schmaltz, for his protest, dies in a nearby livery stable at age 22.
Mayor Stevens, whose political appeal was being a competent businessman, demonstrated a similarly bureaucratic approach to leadership as Governor Hoadley. He sent out invitations to 100 of, quote, the best citizens, unquote, to meet at City Hall on Sunday evening. In other words, he was asking the city's rich to form committees to decide how to handle things rather than displaying any actual leadership. One of the most popular ideas among this group of affluent men was to form vigilance committees around town. Apparently, the irony of rich guys creating vigilante groups to address the problems created by a bunch of rich guys giving birth to a vigilante mob two nights earlier was lost on this 100 of Cincinnati's best citizens. But this never took root, and the meeting didn't accomplish much. A curfew was passed, but with all the excitement in the air, more people were out and about socializing on this Sunday night than usual. Curfew be damned.
Committees were, of course, formed. And some people were given specific tasks. Briggs Swift, a 73-year-old pork baron, was supposed to investigate and provide a report on the state of the barricades. And he set out on that mission when the meeting adjourned at around 7:30. Swift and a friend walked up Main Street, pointing out aspects of the barricades to each other. And when they got roughly a block away from the Main Street barricade, soldiers shouted to them to halt. They did exactly as they were instructed. They froze in their tracks. Nevertheless, guardsmen shot at them, shooting the elderly Swift through one of his thighs. And witnesses said that there was absolutely no justification for the shooting.
Henry Berner, William Berner's father, took down the sign from the family's grocery store on Saturday morning, and the family tried to stay in hiding. Berner's mother was already bedridden by anxiety, depression, and grief. On Sunday evening, people smashed out their grocery's storefront windows.
Colonel Hunt, commander of the 1st Regiment, was, in his personal life, a wealthy man who owned an opulent hotel on 4th Street. Around 11 o'clock on Sunday night, staff and guests grew panicky over a rumor that the hotel was going to be attacked. It was evacuated, but the attack was just a rumor, as it turns out.
Once again, a group of men tie a noose and go to the house of one of the Berner jurors, Henry Bone, to lynch him. When Bone doesn't cooperate by coming out of the house for them, they wander over to Court Street, where they periodically poke around a corner and shoot toward one of the barricades. Although they are hiding behind a building, this led guardsmen to rattle off a Gatling gun down Court Street toward the Court Street Market.
The 14th Regiment said that this resulted in, quote, a number of casualties, unquote. It's unclear how many casualties or the nature of the wounds, but one of them was William Hooper. William and his dad were from New Richmond, Ohio, just upriver from Cincinnati, and they were in town on business. They walked up to the vicinity of Court Street purely out of curiosity, believing that they were maintaining a safe distance from any real trouble. They realized their mistake when the Gatling gun starts going off. Hiding behind a telephone pole, they try to run for better cover in a lull in the firing. But William doesn't make it, and he gets shot through the hand and the thigh. Taken to the hospital, he's expected to recover, but an infection sets in several days later, and he dies on April 8th. Because he dies after the courthouse riot officially ended, he is another person who is among the casualties that don't even make the official death count, which Coroner Muscroft later puts at 53 people.
The last official death of the courthouse riot occurred around 5 o'clock on Monday, when Israel Goetz, a member of the 14th Regiment, became the second member of the National Guard to die, although his death was an accident. Official reports are vague and mildly conflicting, but he was shot in the head when either he dropped his own rifle, or someone around him did. Like Desmond, he would be buried as a hero. Goetz was only 21 and had been a National Guardsman for only about a year.
Aside from the tragedy of Israel Goetz, Monday morning takes us back to where the introduction to this first episode of this story started. It is March 31, 1884. Blood stains the granite pavement, temperature is dropping, and soldiers without enough regulation overcoats have to share them for shifts at the barricades. Almost every window is busted out of the jail, and the back of the building is covered in soot. The courthouse is a smoldering ruin. Coroner Muscroft will place the official death count at 53, but the real number is, as we have seen, significantly higher. And this doesn't account for the full carnage, including a hospital full of men in agonizing pain, many enduring amputations, with their lives and their families' lives permanently altered. And as the sun rises on Monday morning, the finger pointing starts. Who will pay for all of this? In the next episode, we will try to answer those questions, and we'll also explain why the real truths were obfuscated. The truly guilty were given absolution, and a ridiculously inordinate amount of responsibility would be heaped at the feet of criminal defense attorney Thomas C. Campbell. That's it for now. Special thanks to Grab Bag Collab Network for their help on this podcast. And please check out grabbagcollab.com for more podcasts that we think you're really going to love. And additional thanks to our producer and director, Dan Fennessy. We will see you guys next episode.
See you next time.